The vibe is high in the nation of Judah. The country has a godly king who has undertaken a spiritual spring clean, purging his realm of any pagan religious influences. The second book of Chronicles goes into considerably more detail than the second book of Kings, which also covers Hezekiah's reign, but this book is all about Judah. And because the writer doesn't need to bother relating what is happening in the country's godless neighbour Israel to the north, he can spend more time elaborating on Hezekiah's religious reforms. These are not the most action-packed chapters in the Bible, but here at Holy Bible, we skip over nothing. If it's in the Bible, it's in the podcast. This is Holy Bible, episode 98, The Pious and the Proud. Hello again, and welcome back if you're a regular day tripper to this podcast, and welcome aboard if you're new. Here is where we dump the religion at the side of the road and track through the Bible without any judgment, pointed fingers, or thou shalt nots. We're here for the story, the Bible as a book, if you will. There are plenty of Bible studies and meditations on the internet, and plenty of podcasts telling you that the Bible is all hokum. At Holy Bible, we leave you to make your own minds up as to whether any of it is true. That said, the Bible is a book that has impacted Western culture more than any other, and it's one of the few books dating from the Iron Age still in print. For those who've just joined, we're cruising towards the end of the second book of Chronicles. So, buckle up, we're ready to go. Describing Hezekiah's Passover party, it's probably worth recapping what the Passover actually is for any of you who haven't been following along since the early days of this podcast. Feel free to skip back to episode 18 for a more beefy expo on this feast, but here's the short version. After being enslaved on the brickyards of northern Egypt, the Israelites finally had a chance to break for the border. The book of Exodus describes how God sent a battery of plagues to utterly ruin Egypt in the hope that Pharaoh would relent and allow his Hebrew slaves to leave. When Egypt's king failed to break, one final terrible plague was unleashed. The angel of death would visit every house at night and kill any animal or human who was the first male born to its family. To escape the carnage, the Israelites were encouraged to mark the outside of their doorpost with lamb's blood, a clear sign to the angel not to kill anyone inside. In other words, the death angel would pass over these houses. The Israelites were told to hitch their cloaks and their belts and to not add yeast to their bread, as there would be no time to let it rise. Speed and readiness was the order of the day, and when the command was given, they exited the city and made their break for freedom. On the way, Moses received instructions which he believed were from God, telling everyone how to celebrate their miraculous escape and to keep celebrating it. The Passover, as the festival is known, took place in either March or April, around the same time that Christians now celebrate Easter, and becomes one of the Bible's three major community events which all Jews are expected to participate in, with huge crowds descending on Jerusalem. During the reigns of some of Judah's less godly monarchs, all holy days were sidelined, but in his zeal, Hezekiah is keen to get things back on track. The king's party isn't a one-off show of goodwill. The second book of Chronicles spends an entire chapter detailing priestly reforms so that the nation can get back into its spiritual groove. Hezekiah begins his reform of temple life by assigning priests to various divisions, each with a particular responsibility. Some offer sacrifices, some look after the spiritual needs of the people, some offer thanks to God, while others sing praises by the entrances to the temple complex. Hezekiah personally provides the materials to make burnt offerings for the daily morning and evening sacrifices, as well as those that take place every Sabbath, every month at the new moon, and on the special feast days such as Passover and Tabernacles. The king tells his people that they need to support the work of the priests and Levites, and the response from Judah's people is a generous one as they bring the first of their oil, wine, grain, and honey to the temple. Bees are already being farmed for their honey back in Old Testament times. In 2005, clay hives were found by archaeologists in the Jordan Valley. The hives even had the remains of bees in them, which had been imported from what is now Turkey. As momentum builds, people tithe their animals too, and after 5 months of giving, there is such a vast amount of produce that there is a surplus. The high priest Azariah explains to his king that there aren't enough temple workers to use all the food, hence the piles of leftovers. Hezekiah is overjoyed at the generosity and orders storerooms in the temple to be made available for all the food. Levites are appointed to manage the contributions, which are brought into the storerooms before being distributed amongst all the Levitical families who, the writer adds, demonstrated their faith by consecrating themselves to God's work. Another bit of backstory is possibly needed here too. Israel is the name given to a man named Jacob in the book of Genesis. Jacob has 12 sons who each give their name to a tribe, the 12 tribes of Israel. There are actually 13 tribes, and one of Jacob's sons, Joseph, he of Technicolor Dreamcoat fame, is given a double helping. However, only 12 of the tribes are allocated land when the Israelite escapees from Egypt finally arrive in the promised land of Canaan, the land between the Euphrates River and the Mediterranean Sea that aligns with modern-day Israel, Palestine and parts of western Syria and Jordan. The tribe that didn't get land was Levi. This was the tribe that Moses and his brother Aaron were descended from, and given that Aaron became Israel's first high priest, Levi was seen as a priestly tribe. At the time, the Israelites were obliged to dedicate their firstborn children to God, but the tribe of Levi provided them with a useful workaround. If an entire tribe of Israel could be dedicated to serving God, then none of the other families need give up their children. So, from the time of Moses onwards, Levites were employed as temple orderlies, gatekeepers, priestly assistants, and, of course, priests. They received no income, but a proportion of the food and wealth donated to the temple was allocated to them. They were also given cities in which to live and land nearby on which to keep their livestock. As part of Hezekiah's reforms, those priests who live on the pasture lands around Levitical cities are not left out simply because they are far from the city or the temple and are given their fair share of the surplus. There is a palpable sense of well-being, and the suggestion is that the nation properly thrives because Hezekiah keeps his focus wholeheartedly on God. By now, Israel has long since fallen, and the existential threat of Assyria is more real than ever for Judah, especially when envoys from the empire arrive to challenge Hezekiah. In the second book of Kings, Judah has already been conquered by Assyria, which means that Hezekiah is forced to strip the temple of treasure, using it as a bargaining tool to persuade this great eastern empire to back off. However, this isn't enough for Assyria's king Sennacherib, who wants Judah for himself and begins laying siege to several of the country's fortified cities. In the earlier book, Hezekiah is on the back foot as Sennacherib's army arrives at Jerusalem, blocking the aqueduct that brings water into the city. Judah's king appears distraught and desperate as all appears to be lost. Here in Chronicles, Hezekiah is much more in control. He can see that Sennacherib is laying siege to other cities in Judah and assumes correctly that the Assyrians have set their sights on Jerusalem as the ultimate prize. Hezekiah has his engineering boffins block up all rivers and springs in the vicinity of Jerusalem so that the enemy thinks the city will run out of water quickly if it is surrounded. How the locals will survive without water themselves, readers are only told later. The king rebuilds and fortifies the city's walls, builds a second curtain wall around the original, and manufactures weapons and shields. Far from the Assyrians surprising the city, Jerusalem is fully prepared and battle-ready. To motivate his military commanders, Hezekiah gathers them together and reminds them that Sennacherib only has human power on his side, while the army of Judah is the army of God. In the second book of Kings, Sennacherib's generals ridicule God, wrongly believing that Hezekiah removed altars to him from Judah's high places rather than the pagan shrines he actually destroyed. The generals warn Judah's king not to rely on Egypt and promise him horses and chariots should he agree to join forces with Assyria. In Chronicles, Sennacherib's logic is slightly different. He wants to know how God can rescue Judah when all the gods of the other nations which Assyria has conquered were unable to withstand his onslaught. According to Chronicles, Sennacherib himself writes letters to Hezekiah, making fun of him. "The gods of other lands let their people down," he writes, "and Hezekiah's God will be just as powerless against his war machine." As in the previous account, Assyria's generals attract a crowd on the city walls who can hear them shouting their threats in Hebrew, a ploy to alarm and scare them. Aramaic is the language of diplomacy in the Old Testament Near East, whereas Hebrew is the vernacular that the ordinary people can understand. In anguish and desperation, Hezekiah and his spiritual advisor, the prophet Isaiah, pray. God sends his avenging angel to kill almost 200,000 Assyrian troops, and Sennacherib returns home in disgrace to be murdered by his sons. Grateful for the reprieve, Judah's people bring sacrifices to the temple and valuable gifts for their king, while all the nations surrounding it appear to have a newfound respect for Hezekiah's country. The second book of Kings explores Isaiah's involvement in repelling the Assyrian threat in much greater detail, but Chronicles leapfrogs straight to the final years of Hezekiah's reign, Judah's first properly God-oriented one in five generations. Just as in the previous account of his reign, Hezekiah falls gravely ill, but Chronicles doesn't specify the 15 extra years given to him in the second book of Kings. All readers are told here is that the king receives a miraculous sign. The book then describes how Hezekiah gets too big for his boots and behaves with a kind of pride that makes God angry. Readers are reassured that the king turns things round, and for this reason, nothing bad comes the way of the kingdom during his lifetime. The similarities with Solomon continue with an account of Hezekiah's vast wealth. He has acquired precious metal, jewels, spices, shields, and other valuables. He owns so much oil, grain, and wine that they require their own storehouses, and he builds new villages as well as barns and pens for all his livestock. Hezekiah is credited with channeling water from the spring at Gihon, 1,750 feet away. That's 533 meters. As Jerusalem has no river, it requires a water supply, and it is thanks to Hezekiah's enlightened engineers and workmen that the city becomes considerably more invincible. The reservoir is an engineering marvel. It is still known today as Hezekiah's Pool and can be found under the Christian quarter of the old city of Jerusalem. An access tunnel to the spring is known as Warren's Shaft after 19th century archaeologist Sir Charles Warren, who first located it. This vertical shaft allows access to fresh water without leaving the safety of the city. The episode with the Babylonian envoys is glossed over in this account. Rather than show off his storehouses, the chronicler describes Hezekiah as being tested by God to know exactly what is going on in his royal heart. He then refers readers to the book of Isaiah for more details on Hezekiah's life and describes the whole of Jerusalem honouring their king after he has been laid to rest in the royal tombs. Bible fans love it when characters in the book can be verified by evidence outside the Bible. In 2015, a small clay disc or buller bearing the royal seal of Hezekiah, son of Ahaz, was discovered by archaeologists adjacent to Temple Mount. The buller would have been used to seal a rolled-up scroll. So, no leap of faith needed to believe in Hezekiah, just a visit to the Israel Museum in Jerusalem. The reign of Hezekiah's son is considered by the Second Book of Kings as the low point in Judah's monarchy. At least in the Second Book of Chronicles, the renegade ruler manages to redeem himself a little. It might be hard to imagine how a king who builds altars to Baal, sacrifices his own children in pagan fire ceremonies, and places an Asherah pole in the Jerusalem temple can bounce back into God's good books. But it seems that with God, no one is unreachable or unforgivable. Chronicles paints the same picture of an utterly pagan Jewish king as the Second Book of Kings. With his love of omens, spiritualists and witchcraft, Manasseh's Judah is described as more evil than any of the nations which God drove away so that the Israelites could settle in Canaan. Long-time devotees of this podcast, or anyone who's already read the Bible, knows that Israel and Judah weren't always Israel and Judah. Israel was originally a nation of nomads who settled in Egypt until things took a turn for the worse and a new pharaoh used them as a vast unpaid labour force. Led by Moses, they escaped, and after 40 years wandering in the Sinai wilderness, they finally entered the land that had been promised to their ancestor Abraham centuries earlier. In super simple terms, Abraham was the first Jew, a virtuous pagan who listened to God and did whatever he was told, and who was promised descendants as numerous as the stars in the night sky and the grains of sand on the shore. However, the land which the Israelites entered was not vacant. Known as Canaan, it was home to a large number of tribal kingdoms who worshipped a plethora of gods, all of them pagan. According to the accounts in the Bible, God found these religions detestable, which is why he allowed the Israelites to conquer Canaan with minimal resistance from the defenders. The land was carved up among the 12 tribes, and only when its fourth king Rehoboam fails to convince Israel that he is fit to rule, does the nation split in two. 10 tribes remain Israel, while Judah and Benjamin combine to form Judah, keeping hold of Jerusalem and its temple. Israel then descends into pagan worship, and falls apart under an attack from Assyria in the early 8th century BC, something the Bible's prophets repeatedly warned would happen. Meanwhile, Judah clings on, thanks to godly kings such as Hezekiah, but falters thanks to pagan ones like Manasseh. In the Second Book of Kings, God announces that he is going to wipe Jerusalem clean like a dish because of Manasseh's unwavering paganism, and that this is why the nation ultimately loses its independence and sees its people taken captive. Chronicles gives the story a different spin. God attempts to speak to Manasseh, but is roundly ignored, and so the king is captured by Assyrian army commanders, shackled, and led away to Babylon with a hook in his nose. Here, with time to reflect and reconsider, he appears to turn wholeheartedly back to God. According to the chronicler, God is so moved at how Manasseh humbles himself that he brings him home to Jerusalem. By now, the king is a changed man. He rebuilds Jerusalem's outer wall and places military commanders in all of Judah's fortified cities. He then removes all altars to foreign gods in his country, including the ones which he himself placed in the temple. Manasseh recommissions the altar in the temple, offering sacrifices here, possibly for the first time in his life, and orders everyone to worship God. Old habits die hard, and Judah's people continue to worship at the high places associated with pagan deities. Only now they use them to worship the God of Israel. Even so, it's a dramatic turnaround, and thanks to the chronicler, Manasseh doesn't exit the Bible as Judah's most evil king. Regardless of any personal turnarounds, however, the die has been cast. The first readers of the Book of Chronicles will have known only too well what happens next. It's why their parents and grandparents were exiled and why their spiritual homeland is still in ruins. There is no need for cliffhangers or plot twists. The entire second book of Kings is a spoiler for pretty much everything that happens in the second book of Chronicles. Readers know that Judah is going down and the returned Jews will have been chastened by the chronicler's words. This is how their nation fell. This is why. It's up to them to rebuild and make sure it never happens again. The second book of Chronicles season's finale is next. Holy Bible is written and produced by me, Chaz Bayfield, with music by Michael Old and John Hawkins Music. Cover art is by Lisa Goff. You can send any comments or feedback to contact@holybible.com or find us on X, just search Holy Bible Podcast. Thanks again for listening. It really does mean a lot to me and makes this whole project worthwhile. Take care and see you next time.